That Bubbler Talk first aired in 2016, which is when I first interviewed Steve Schaffer, the archivist from the Milwaukee County Historical Society, who is featured in the story. We spoke at length about how Germans were treated during World War II and World War I.
While there were many Germans still living in Milwaukee during the Second World War, Schaffer explains what changed in the years between the two World Wars.
The city had a distinct German heritage and flavor, even after World War I, when the city went through a purging of its German heritage as a response to World War I.
So let's look at that. World War I comes around. We're fighting the Germans. And, you know, this is the initial battle, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
How is Milwaukee perceived in Wisconsin? How is it perceived in the nation in general?
Because of the large German population, it was viewed as perhaps a questionable, vulnerable segment of the population that wouldn't support the war wholeheartedly. So even until 1916, 1917, you'll see German language magazines and newspapers in Milwaukee that are kind of portraying the German side, the Central Power side of the war, and there will be relief funds and organizations that will, you know, send relief to German war widows and things like that. That changed with the U.S. entry into World War I, and that's when the real crackdown came on Germans. They were issued identification cards, and first-generation German immigrants, males 16 and up, were given ID cards. They were not allowed to go in certain areas of the city where it was considered sensitive for war production. And then that restriction was applied to women in 1918, and you were restricted in your movements. You were restricted as to what you could do as far as work. The Milwaukee press had like a loyalty patrol in the newspaper, you know, who they thought wasn't loyal enough. So it was a real sense of hysteria. Buildings were changed. People's names were changed to become more anglicized. German language was no longer taught in the schools as well. So there was a real paranoia, certainly locally, about Germans. National level, it's hard to say how Milwaukee was perceived. You know, nationally, we were known as a German town, along with Cincinnati and St. Louis. But there was a real effort locally to curb the German influence. I'm sure you've heard the story about sauerkraut was liberty cabbage. It was some of the same things that happened post 9/11 with some of our response to our European allies and things had their foreshadowing in World War I. A lot of the same hysteria. The Germania building was renamed the Brumder building, and there was a large statue symbolizing Germania, which the building got its name from, and that was removed and put away in storage. In fact, there's still speculation about where that statue actually is. And, you know, people like Victor Berger, who were, you know, he was a socialist. He was also a pacifist, you know, went to prison. He was charged with sedition. There was a reinstitution of the Alien and Sedition Act, which, you know, allowed people to be jailed if they opposed the war in any way, shape, or form. It was things like that. I mean, there weren't any camps. There weren't internment camps like with the Japanese Americans during World War II. But there was definitely a concerted effort to know who the Germans were and where they were going. So there was a real hysteria about, you know, traitors among us, the fifth column. And because there were a lot of close family ties with the old country and had been right up until the beginning of World War I. I mean, Milwaukee was known as the Midwest Munich. It was, you know, a German town. So the response in World War I was radically different than the response in World War II. By then, a whole other group of Germans had been acclimated to American culture. And pre-World War II, primarily Germans who had immigrated after World War I, who were still very sensitive to Germany and were still very incensed about the Versailles Treaty and saw in this supposed rise in Germany and a reestablishment of German pride, there was a real appreciation of that here. So there was a Friends of New Germany was one of the organizations that developed, and from that came the German-American Bund, which was a very active pro-Nazi party. They had all the trappings of the Nazis. You know, they were known as the Silver Shirts, or locally they were just the Bund, but they were the goose-stepping, swastika and Hitler-saluting Nazis. They would have some conventions. They had a park in Grafton, I believe, Camp Hindenburg, and that's a place where they went to drill and things like that.
And they were called the Bund, and they were from Milwaukee?
They were from Wisconsin area and the Milwaukee area. The German-American Volksbund was the exact name, Volks, People's Union, but they were known as the Bund.
And how were they perceived here? Because, of course, Milwaukee at the time had a socialist mayor. Even by the 1940s, it already had a rich history of socialism.
Well, and there was quite a... You have to remember at that time, too, that, you know, the Spanish Civil War was going on. There was a real sense in the world that there was a fight between forms of government. And because America was still in the Depression and had not really recovered and started its wartime production that really kicked it out of the Depression, communism was still considered a viable option. There wasn't a lot known about all the things going on in the Soviet Union, but what you did know was that, you know, people were working, and it looked like a more prosperous and well-organized way of government than what we had. So the communists were very anti-German, or anti-fascist, I should say. Milwaukee's Jewish population was incredibly activated by this Bund. And a lot of Germans, older Germans, Germans who had been in America, rejected this resurgent fascist Germany. And you'll see this. We do have photographs from a gentleman named Lyle Overweis, who's done a lot of photography in Milwaukee. He has some black and white images. This is closer to World War II, though. These are from maybe 1939 and 1940, but they're very obvious Memorial Day floats that are anti-fascists. In fact, one of them I can remember had a person riding on a float and was actually on a swastika, similar to being chained to a crucifix. It was quite a graphic image, but it was in a parade in Milwaukee. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, while there were some Germans that were motivated by the fascist message of Hitler, there were just as many Germans and other groups that rejected it.
So when we're looking at the German population at that time, it was mostly people who had been here a long time. But as you said, people who were newer immigrants, they were more likely to be sort of Nazi sympathizers?
Yes, and that's primarily where most of the members of the Bund, they were from, you know, post-World War I immigrants. There was a real sense that they had been cheated and treated very shabbily by the Versailles Treaty. And kind of the resurgent, masculine, strong Germany that the Nazis portrayed appealed to a lot of them. I'm not saying in Wisconsin, I don't have any numbers to give you, but there was a movement to return to the fatherland in the pre-World War II period. People did go back, especially if you hadn't completed your immigration process, which there wasn't the compulsion that there is now, you know, where you have a green card or you're this or that. You had a declaration of intent and you had some time to figure out whether you wanted to be a citizen or not. You could reapply for that. Some people never became citizens. They stayed in the country without ever becoming a citizen. So some of them were able to go back to Germany. But that's where the main group of the German-American Volksbund came from, is this newer group of German immigrants.
So once we really got into World War II, how were the Bund treated?
Oh, they were disbanded. Most of them, I think, saw the writing on the wall, and it's like, you know, we can't continue to remain, you know, in this group. The organization itself really collapsed once Adolf Hitler declared war on Germany, declared war on the United States after the Japanese attack. We didn't declare war on Germany. They declared war on us, and that pretty much put an end to the Bund. I do have a copy of, it's called the German American, and it's a newspaper from February 1943, and, you know, the top headline is Smash the Axis, the manifesto of the German Underground Conference. So this is a German-American paper that supports the movement against Adolf Hitler in Germany and, you know, speaks of you know, Hitler too attacked labor. I mean, it would appear to be more of a sort of a socialist, more of a left labor paper. Half of it's in German, half of it's in English. You know, some of the headlines, Hitler's biggest mistake. You know, and there's even a photograph of a German-American who's in the 32nd Division fighting in New Guinea, and he's considered the hero of Buna, which was a battle that the 32nd Division was engaged in New Guinea against the Japanese. So there's a real sense that we're German-Americans, we're proud, and we're fighting fascism. So, and there's even a reference to Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., who was the commander of the famous Tuskegee Airmen, and it's a slap in Jim Crow's face, a people's army, and it, you know, talks about Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., becoming a lieutenant general. So, I mean, it's quite an interesting newspaper. It's not, I believe it's printed in New York, and it has a slight feel of, I don't want to say communist, but it is. Well, you know, it's the UAW, the CYO, CIO. So it is it's a union publication. It would be considered a left publication, and by some, it might be considered, you know, almost communist influence. But
which was pretty popular here.
Yes.
You know, it's pretty counterintuitive, I guess. Speaking as a millennial, I think of World War II as being a much larger indictment of the German people than World War One, but it seems like during World War One they were really persecuted.
They were, and it's a stark difference in the United States. The Japanese bore the brunt of that in World War Two, but you're right. I mean, that's a good characterization. The Germans kind of went through their purging in World War One. By World War Two, there wasn't that big of an issue. I mean, I've done enough research for people and come across enough newspaper articles where there would be a report of somebody being arrested because they were intoxicated and said Hitler's going to win the war, you know, and they happen to be German, and it's that kind of thing. But it was never any kind of real, you know, movement. There was no fifth column among the Germans who would support Nazis at all. And you know what? Their sons were drafted. Their sons were fighting for the United States, and their daughters. So in World War II, they were definitely Americans, not Germans. And I mean, that's the other thing, too, to the point. The Germans who came to Wisconsin were for the most part, really free thinkers. They were fleeing the revolutions in Europe of 48, so they were anti-monarchy. Although they may practice a religion, they were very much anti-state religions, and a lot of them were just, you know, free thinkers, period. So they had no religious affiliation. They may consider themselves like deists in that there may be some broad clockwork god who may have set things in motion. So those types of Germans kind of grew and flourished in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, and that's the real tragedy, I think, of World War One, is that, in my view, they were unjustly targeted as enemies by a U.S. government that had to sell a war. And those types of Germans were so different than the post-World War One immigrants who, you know, kind of drifted toward the Nazi movement.
Steve Schaffer is an archivist for the Milwaukee County Historical Society. I spoke with him in 2016 for our Bubbler Talk series.